All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. It's called WTF. Welcome to it. I don't want to get too lost in the darkness or the light, but here I would like to say that Marsha Warfield is on the show today. We reached out to her to have her on a while back, actually, and it was tough to schedule because she lives in Las Vegas. But now that we're doing things remote, it was a good time to have her on since she's part of the Comedy Store history and a definite important player in modern stand-up history. Might not remember her from Night Court. She's going to be here. She is here. I talked to her. You'll hear it today. How's everybody holding up in this 50-state death factory? What's going on out there? Are you staying safe? Are you okay? Are you keeping it together? Kind of. A lot of people are shredding. A lot of people are sad. A lot of people are losing people. A lot of people are just trying to fucking keep it together, man. I get it. I definitely get it. It's a weird time because I think I said this towards the beginning of this thing. I said, however long this is going to go on for, people are going to come out of it knowing exactly who they are, what they are made of. Who are you? Because here's what's happening. I think that a lot of people, I would imagine that the veneer of self is starting to wear down, to wear off. The sort of coating that you call who you are, the puppet you inhabit, is probably breaking down a bit, and there you are, right? Look at me. Look at me when the puppet's broken. For those of us who based a good portion of our relevance on how we're seen or what we do in the world, if you're not doing that in the world, even if you're just not going out in the world. I talked to a buddy of mine, hadn't been to a fucking grocery store in 5 months, really locked down, and went out and because he had to go to the doctor and had a couple exchanges, just regular exchanges with human beings, and was moved to tears at the strange realization that we need that. We need it. So however you're deprived, I mean, a lot of you have people, and a lot of you, like me, are sort of having people over, having dinners with people, distanced dinners, and going out in the world a bit and, you know, safely, sitting outside a lot, waving at friends, calling people. I mean, I really try to get as much of that as possible. But I think on the other side of that, even if you have family or whoever you're hanging out with on a day-to-day basis, if you're sense of self is based on how you are seen or what you do or your job out in it, and you can't go out in it anymore, I would imagine that there's some moment of who the fuck am I happening? Who am I without all that? Possibly broke, sadly. Hopefully not. But who am I without that stuff? And that's some, there's a lot of soul searching going on that none of us signed up for. I'm fortunate in that I can do my job here. But I didn't sign up to be the guy whose girlfriend died and he's crying at night talking to his cat again. And the cat's dying too. I didn't sign up for that. I didn't sign up for the man who has to sit quietly on his porch with a heavy heart wondering what it means. How do we integrate death into our lives? I think that's a question everyone's asking, and it's something that we have to deal with personally. Loss, but also just the fact of so much death around. Hey, but I don't want to be a bummer. You know, my girlfriend got nominated for an Emmy for Best Directing for Little Fires Everywhere, I believe for the finale episode. Lynn Shelton is nominated for a directing Emmy for a drama series or miniseries or whatever it is. Limited series. Very exciting. She would be so fucking thrilled, and she is so deserving of that nomination and of that award. She was great at her job. She was great when she did it with complete creative freedom, and great when she did it to honor the vision of somebody else. I'm very proud of her, and I'm so sad that she can't be here for this honor. Whatever you think of awards, I've talked about them before. Like when your peers honor you, it means something. And she would just be thrilled, and I know her family's thrilled. I know all of her friends are excited for her, and I think everybody just wishes that she would call them and tell them how excited she is. But it's a beautiful thing that she got nominated, and you know, whether she wins or not, I don't think it matters to her. Maybe it does. I don't know how the afterlife works, but that was some good news, and it was exciting news and bittersweet for sure. But very excited for Lynn. I will think of her as if she's here and what she would be thinking. She would just be bouncing off the fucking walls. I'll tell you that. It's weird, man. Something is hovering around my being with this loss everywhere. And it's not bad. It's not bad. Maybe it's because I'm in my 50s and maybe I'm heading into my late 50s. I'm going to be 57 in a few months. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen to all of us at some point. But the things that die, they just hover there. They're still here. Everything's still here. Everything's still with you. It's just there's less clutter. There's less responsibility in a way. But that makes the love even more pure. Strange thing, life. And I know that, you know, honoring the dead and honoring the legacy of the creative people that have been in our lives, like Lynn and like her parents, you know, put out a statement about her Emmy nomination that was quite beautiful, a testament to her collaborative abilities, but also her complete control over her craft. But it basically says that Lynn is honored by the Television Academy is not only a tribute to her accomplishments as a director, but her style of directing. Always in control, but kind-hearted, making the final decisions, but always soliciting input from her co-workers. Co-workers, yes, that is how she regarded everyone on set, from grips and gaffers and set and costume designers to the director of photography and the actors. This is an honor for the ultimate collaborationist, who knew that she would produce her best if she teased the best out of her teammates. Very sweet. She certainly teased the best out of me. I'll tell you that. Take a breath, man. Take a breath. Cry it out, people. So I got an email that speaks to something I've been saying to other people. You know, people are like, when are we going to go back to work? When are we going to go back to work? And the only thing I can think of, and I've been saying this for weeks, months, is that there's no work until there's a test that we can all take every day. Something easy, something practical, something that we can have 10 of in our medicine cabinet. Something, you know, simple as a diabetes test, as a blood test, as maybe even a little machine that does it. I don't know, but I don't see how anything happens without that. And I got this letter from this guy, a teacher, who said, "Dear Mark, Dear Mark, I can honestly say that not a week has gone by in the last 12 years that I haven't thought about writing to you about something. Never more so than during your recent tragic time of loss and grief. I am so sorry. Thank you. I finished 12 years of graduate school in 2008. The economy collapsed and I was unemployed for 10 years. I'm just a few years older than you. Throughout that decade, sharing your journey kept me searching for my podcast from a garage. I found it. I'm a public high school science teacher. You also helped me quit smoking. This is why I'm writing now. There are new developments. There is a growing realization the only way out of this crisis will require cheap, daily, rapid at-home tests for COVID-19. The good news is that these tests exist now. We call upon Congress to mandate and fund the approval, manufacture, and distribution of these tests to every household in America. When I say we, I mean me and a guy I know named John." Okay, that's what it is, in parentheses. Please add your voice to ours. It's louder. Your activism has inspired me to send the attached letter and accompanying information to all of my elected representatives, my union, my favorite media outlets. This is an underreported story. I hope you will talk about it. Mark, you have all my love, admiration, gratitude, and my deepest sympathy, Daniel. So, look, this is true. And you should know that it obviously has to happen. It's happening in other countries, but here we have such a tremendous leadership vacuum and a government that is so fucking broken that I don't know if it's going to happen. Will there be wealthy people who are able to obtain at-home rapid tests? Yes. Will there be industries that use them to make sure they can generate revenue? Yes. Will you be able to get one because your government thinks it's a smart thing to do? Of course not. Of course not. Right now, they can't even agree to emergency spending methods or mask mandates. It's fucking ridiculous. It's a grifter's picnic. And this will not change, folks, until you get rid of the people who are the problem. If you want rapid at-home testing, you better vote in November. It's not happening until there are new people in charge. So, right now, I'd like to share my conversation with one of the great women of comedy, Marcia Warfield. We talked, she was in Vegas. She's in Vegas. It was a nice chat. It was nice to see her, nice to meet her. Now it's another person I can put into the pantheon of people I have talked to from the Comedy Store's history, from comedy history. This is me and Marcia Warfield. Hi, Marcia.
Hi.
I just texted Mike Binder to ask him if you talked to him for the documentary.
Yes, I did.
It was funny because I interviewed him years ago in the old garage in person. And when I talked to him, he didn't even want to talk about the Comedy Store. And I told him, you got to talk about the Comedy Store. And now he can't get enough of it. Now it's like he is the guy that's putting together the most thorough history of that place.
Yeah, it's ever. About 400 hours or so by now, isn't it?
It's got to be. Yeah. It's got to be. And I went over there. It's so weird because I was a doorman at the Comedy Store in the 80s. And I went over there and Peter Shore let us go through her stuff in that office.
Okay.
Upstairs. And I have her driver's license. That's Mitzi Shore.
I got to deal with my driver's license.
I just know it's a one-of-a-kind souvenir.
Everybody who was at the store when I was there does a spot on Mitzi.
Of course. So, you grew up, where'd you grow up?
Chicago.
The whole time in Chicago.
Yeah, I left Chicago. I started doing stand-up in Chicago in 1974.
74?
Yes.
What was the scene in Chicago? Like, who was around? What was that? Like, where were you performing?
Well, I started at a place called the Pickle Barrel.
Huh.
Tom Dreesen had just broken up with his partner, Tim Reed.
Right.
And had started a Monday night open mic.
Huh.
To work out. And at that time, that was almost pretty much brand new. The Improv was around in New York, and I think the Comedy Store might have been starting, but it was a new concept and it was new to Chicago. We weren't known for stand-up.
Right. It was mostly a sketch town, Compass Players, Second City. I talked to Tom, fairly recently, and that was pretty amazing. He's got kind of an amazing story. And him and his partner, Tim Reed? Yeah. They were kind of a big act for a while.
Well, yeah. And they were groundbreaking. They were the first interracial comedy team, and comedy teams were much more common than they are now.
Right.
They did pretty well. And then they went their separate ways. And so Tom had this open mic and they featured it in the Sunday Sun Times.
And you had never done comedy before? You just were curious?
And I was 22 years old and working at the phone company, and saw no future there and had no idea what I wanted to do. So I saw that and I told a friend, I'm going to go out down there and do that. They said anybody can go up. I'm going to do that. And she said, okay. So I started writing stuff down, but a couple of months went by and I didn't go. And she kept asking me, when are you going? When are you going? And I kept saying, well, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. So she showed up at my house one Monday at about 6 o'clock in the evening and said, put your clothes on. We're going. I'm not ready to go, but put your clothes on. We're going. So I put my clothes on and we went down there. We were way too early.
Yeah.
We sat there and finally about 9, 10 o'clock, I guess, Tom showed up and she went and introduced me. And at that time, we introduced all the comedians as virgins.
Yeah.
So, I finally went on about two.
How'd it go?
9 scotches.
Yeah.
So it was a bunch of comics, 3 drunks at a table, and the guys sweeping up because they used to have sawdust on the floor.
Please, Yeah.
And so I went on and I did the stuff I had. Well, I opened with, my name's Marshall Warfield and I'm a virgin, so please be kind.
Yeah.
And went from there. The comedians loved me. And the drunks were like, yeah, you're all right. So Tom invited me back, and that was the beginning.
Did you and Tom come out at the same time out here?
No, Tom left maybe a year or so before I did. And I worked around Chicago. I did a lot of jazz clubs. I did a lot of folk clubs. I did a lot of, you know, whatever was available. And then I got a job as a house comic in a upscale urban jazz club. They had a 16-piece band. And,
oh, wow.
They were trying to bring, you know, an upscale venue to the far south side of Chicago. Which, if you know that, that's a pretty remarkable thing. And it was 1974, 75. But I'm 22 years old. I got one cocktail dress. And at that time, you had to dress up. You know, we still had supper clubs. We still had Mr. Kelly's and the Happy Medium and places where, you know, you got really dressed up and had dinner and saw Nancy Wilson or Frank Sinatra.
Right.
And so I got to have my one cocktail dress. And I went down there and they gave me the job. And there were 6 owners. And it was $100 a week, 2 shows a night, 5 nights a week.
Wow.
And they asked me if I wanted to get paid at the end of the week or every night. I said, I didn't pay me every night. So every night, the owners individually would come to me and ask me if I had gotten paid. And I'd say no.
Yeah.
So I would end up getting $100 a night. And I did that for as long as the club was open. And then I went on and did other things. And after a couple of years, I figured, you know, all the clubs were closing, all of
the dinner clubs.
Yeah. Everybody was moving to Los Angeles. The Tonight Show had moved in like 73.
From New York. Yeah. And now when you were doing those clubs, were you opening for a lot of musical acts?
Yeah. Well, like I said, opening with the band, a 16-piece jazz band.
Yeah.
I did a lot of those kinds of shows. And then a lot of times we would just, you know, find a venue and ask them if they had a mic. And if they said yes, then we said, well, can we do a show? And they'd say yes. And then we would entertain the 4 drunks at the bar.
So you decided to move to Los Angeles in what, 76?
Yes. March 8th, 1976. Well, March 5th, it was my birthday. I left on my birthday.
How's your family feel about it? Like, do you come from a big family over there?
Not a big family, but I was 22 and too stupid to be scared.
Right.
And it was 1976. You have to remember, at that time, people were still hitchhiking across the country.
Right.
And they had drive-aways. You could rent somebody's car and drive it for them to Los Angeles or wherever else they wanted you to.
Yeah.
But there were all kinds of little caravans of kids headed out to Los Angeles, especially to heading out to California, a lot to San Francisco, as the hate and everything was still, you know,
yeah,
the hate. And
yeah.
I had told my mother I was going to California, hook or by crook. I didn't care if I had to, you know, hitchhike, catch a ride, whatever, I was going.
Yeah.
And so she finally got tired of that and gave me a trip to Los Angeles for my birthday.
She probably thought you were going to come back.
Right. 2 weeks at the Continental Hyatt House.
Oh, yeah.
And
right next door to the Comedy Store?
Yes. That's why I chose it. It's right next door to the Comedy Store.
So you had done some research.
Oh, sure.
What did you know about the Comedy Store before you got out there?
That was where all the comedians went to
work out,
be seen, you know, make their fame and fortune. It was the place at that. It had become the place. Freddie Prinze, Jimmy Walker, they were on TV at that time. And
right. And so like that was, and Richard was there 73, 74, 75. So he was around.
He got by occasionally, but the regulars were Jimmy Walker, Jay Leno. Letterman was the MC.
So so what happens? You go out for the 2 weeks and you audition?
I went out for 2 weeks. I went to the Comedy Store that night, the night I got there. Mm-hmm. And I told them I was a comedian. They let me in. And the guy at the door was John Witherspoon.
Yes.
And I told him I was from Chicago. He said, okay, baby, sit back here and I'll introduce you to everybody. And he did. Everybody that came in, he introduced me. And she's from Chicago and blah, blah, blah. And then Paul Mooney came in about midnight. Uh-huh. And Paul, I want you to meet somebody. And he introduced me to Paul. And this is Paul Mooney. And Paul said, Mr. Paul Mooney. I said, okay. And then he laughed. And I said, I know you. I know you. I know you. You laughed on that Richard Pryor album. You're the guy who laughed because I could hear that same ah-ha-ha.
Really?
Craps after hours.
Right.
And so I said, you're the guy. You wrote on that. Then he said, yes. And so then we were friends from that point on. And I got to meet all of the comedians that were down there. And so I told Spoon I wanted to come by and just hang out, you know, since I was only going to be there for a couple of weeks. He said, fine, come back. Come anytime, just come on in. And I did. That was a Friday and Saturday, Sunday, something like that.
So you got to watch everybody.
On Monday night, I signed up and went on.
Yeah.
And another guy who had just gotten to town and his first night was Argus Hamilton. He and I were comedy virgins together. And you couldn't find two more different people.
That's for sure.
We just are polar opposites.
Oklahoma preacher's kid.
Yeah. 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 And I just saw a post from him saying, you know, my grandpappy fought for that flag. And so we both share the same Comedy Store birthday.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we both became regulars.
You still, Mitzi saw you?
I don't know. I never really paid a lot of attention to Mitzi. I mean, I paid attention to her. I just signed up, you know. I just signed up, and if I got spots, I got spots. If I didn't, I didn't. I don't, you know. I didn't know there was a genuflecting ritual that one was supposed to do.
You didn't? How did you not know?
Yeah, I didn't care. It wasn't the only place I worked either. I mean, we would go to places like the 20 Grand and places in Inglewood and Compton and work out there too.
What was the vibe at the store in the sense of like, did it seem like it was pretty balanced? Like, you know, all kinds of people, women, black people, white people. Did you find that or am I just making that up?
Nah, we didn't find that. We had the late night spots.
Oh, really? So, okay. So it was like that.
And if Mooney showed up,
yeah,
we didn't get those. And if Richard showed up, Mooney didn't get it. There was a hierarchy and we got the last spots of the of the night. And
no, oh, really?
There were very few women. There was a couple of other black women besides Shirley. There was a woman named Brenda Verrett and Roberta Peril. Mm-hmm. And they were both, we were all jockeying for the same one spot, you know. And this was before they started the franchising and the three-act comedy norm.
Right, right, the clubs, yeah.
When that started, I started working at the Laugh Stop in Newport Beach. And I got to be a regular there. And that was the first club I got the headline.
So when you went there, you went out there for 2 weeks, you auditioned, then you went back to Chicago and you just got your stuff and came back?
Never went back. Got a job as a switchboard operator for an answering service. Back then, we didn't have the voicemails and stuff like
right,
that.
Right.
So if, when you wanted, you were big time.
Yeah.
And you had someone else answer your phone. I was the one who answered celebrity phones.
Oh, yeah? Was that exciting? Did you get any memorable incidents?
Well, it was exciting for me. I mean, you know, when Bill Bixby's phone rang, you tried to be the one who got it.
Yeah.
Then there were some people who weren't nice at all. Really? And you got to, you know.
Experience that firsthand?
Sure.
So how did you, because I know you did the Richard Pryor show. Were you finding that, I mean, you were like, did you feel like you were at least part of the gang? I mean, seemed like there was either one gang or two gangs, or like, it seems like I'd like to picture that everybody was sort of tight at a certain point. Was that the case or no?
Well, the politics of the room
yeah.
are different than the politics of the comedians. I mean, the comedians, we were all in the parking lot smoking weed. We were all, you know, hanging out. We were friends.
Right.
As far as jockeying for spots, that's a whole different
Sure, thing. Of course. So, yeah.
We got to know each other and you got to hear different perspectives. Like I said, Argus is from a whole different world than me.
Yeah.
And being able to talk and you know, face-to-face, one-on-one, and have really serious conversations was nice. And to also hear that Charlie Hill,
you know,
he would go on stage and say, I went to Custer Memorial Junior High. Yeah. It puts things in a perspective you've never heard before. And so there was that going on, but there was also, you know, why is that guy going on before me? I've got as much material as him.
Yeah, yeah. Fuck that guy.
Yeah. Showbiz.
Yeah, Charlie Hill, like, is still to this day. I mean, I feel there's a whole little world of new Native American comedians that I haven't really talked to. And I didn't get to talk to him because he had passed away. But he was really, like, the only one for many years that represented, you know, that ethnic group. And he was really good. He was great. Nice guy, too.
He was. He was a sweetheart. And Andy Bumatai from Hawaii. And like I said, just different people from different backgrounds that you'd never really run across any other way. And that was the beauty of watching, sitting in the comedy store and watching comedy.
For sure.
I got to see all those different perspectives.
And when was everybody gunning for the Tonight Show? When was your first TV spot?
You know, there's always been people with different formulas about how to make it.
Yeah.
And I realized early on, there is no one way to make it. No two performers ever made it the exact same way. Everybody follows their own path. And so the Tonight Show and the mechanics of it, that people were, you know, well, you need two giggles, a laugh, a chuckle, and a ha-ha within the first 30 seconds. And then I was like, I can't build an act that way.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel natural to me. And so I never really pursued the Tonight Show. I did the Jim Nabors Show. I did the Mac Davis Show. I did Merv Griffin Show.
Wait a minute. The Jim Nabors Variety Show.
Yeah.
This is like, you know, you have these experiences. That was sort of still when, you know, old show business was in charge, right?
I did the Alan King Show.
How long did these shows even last? I mean, I kind of remember them from when I was a kid, but like Mac Davis had a variety show, right?
Yeah.
And Jim Nabors was a variety show, and the Alan King show. They would just try variety shows with everybody. Like, was the Alan King show on that long?
Not really. But yeah. And he was one of the last of the suit and tie cigarette.
Yeah.
You know, drink in hand comics. Yeah. And Red Fox were, I can't think of others that were still working. But then the Dean Martin roast was still on, too.
Did you do that?
I did the Tommy Chong roast, though, in Vegas with on the Playboy Channel.
Oh,
and wow. I started working the Playboy Channel. You have to remember, Showtime and HBO were startups.
Right.
Most people didn't have Showtime, HBO, or the Playboy Channel. But those were, they were pretty much all in the same thing. So I liked the Playboy Channel for the freedom and smut of it.
What about the Richard Pryor show? Because that thing is kind of like that. I've watched that once or twice, and that just felt like he just went down to the Comedy Store and got everybody to come down on a bus or something.
Well, Mooney was instrumental in that. Mooney was a writer and was very involved with the production.
Yeah.
And so when Richard wanted an ensemble, he just asked us. At first it went per sketch. They needed people to do certain sketches, Star Wars sketch and whatever for the opening. And so we went down for that. And then the next week, they were like, well, you guys work, let's stick with this group. And so pretty much it ended up being a core group, but we weren't hired for the run of the series.
Who was it? It was you and was Sandra Bernhardt there yet?
Or Sandra Bernhardt, Tim Reed, the Mooney twins, Mooney Spoon, Robin,
yeah.
I think it was the first thing he did.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Just about everybody pretty much got a chance to do it who wanted to or who was available.
And did you get to know Richard at all or no?
Well, see, I had been at the Comedy Store, and I would sit in the back and just watch comics. And so if somebody didn't show up, I was available to take that spot.
Right.
And then it became a thing where when the heavy hitters would show up, and, take somebody's spot, because, of course, who's going to deny Richard Pryor or whoever's spot? So they would take the spot, and then everybody would say they didn't want to follow him. So they would ask him if they could go on in front of him.
Right.
And most of the time, Richard said, sure. Well, he asked me if I wanted to go on in front of him. I said, no. I said, I learned in Chicago the hard way. It doesn't matter who went on in front of you. You do your set, whatever it is. You do your thing. If people, if they're through with comedy after they saw that guy, they'll leave with him. The people who stayed want to see more comedy. So don't cheat yourself or them. Do your set. So he asked me, and I said no. And that went on for a while. And then one night he goes on, and I go in the back to get a drink. And the next thing I know, they're going, Richard's introducing you. What do you mean, Richard? Richard's introducing you. He's calling you up on stage right now.
Yeah.
So I run back, up the steps, and I'm standing there, and he said, I want you to listen to this lady. She's really funny. Yeah, I like her a lot. And he introduced me, and I went up and did my set in front of him. And I found out later that he appreciated that I never asked to go on first. He thought that was kind of weak.
Yeah.
The people who did. And so.
So he respected you.
Yeah.
I guess, he definitely had a sweet side to him.
Well, he was very shy and soft-spoken most of the time. Like Robin.
Uh-huh.
It's not until the lights come on, and they take the stage, and then something happens and they become who they are.
It's amazing, though, that you learn those skills, because that's really true. That whole idea of, you know, that you go up and do you no matter what the situation is. And that's all you can do. And in the sense that, like, because there's those people that want to go before a big act or else they try to jump on the energy of the person before them or whatever. But none of that's going to matter in the long run if you don't know who you are.
No. And so it helped me a lot when the next year or so I entered the San Francisco comedy competition.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Who was in you? 79?
Yeah.
I did it in 92 and 93. Who was in your year?
Dana Carvey.
Yeah.
And I don't remember everybody. And, you know, some... Because, see, they had a national, too, and I don't remember if who did which one. Robert Wall.
Yeah.
Mike Powell. A lot of people didn't make it to the finals. Just about everybody went up.
It was a crazy, was it crazy back then where it was just kind of, you never knew what was going on or how they were judging? And
So, I mean, I went, and, I think it was a month long thing. You had to do a month of shows.
Oh, I got it. I found it. It was in the finals. It was you, Mike Davis, Dana Carvey, Michael Winslow.
Yeah.
And A. Whitney Brown.
A. Whitney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you go up. So you just heard about it or you'd been working up in San Francisco?
I had been working the Punchline for a while too. That was another club I got the headline early.
Yeah. And you won.
And I missed a show.
Huh.
You remember that, at that time, you did like 6 shows for the finals and they dropped the lowest score. Well, I got lost trying to find the venue. I got totally lost and turned around. By the time I got there, the show was over. And so I couldn't go on. And everybody was like, okay, well, she's out the competition. She missed the whole show. And I said, what difference does it make if you throw away an 8.5 or a 0? You throw it away. That was in the trash. So,
yeah.
Then I went on and, you know, the other 5 counted and I managed to win. But I managed to win because I learned that it doesn't matter who you follow. The jockeying for spots in the competition was funny. It was a mad world kind of funny. Well, I don't want to go first. You go first, you go last. You're in the middle. Nobody remembers that. So I said, I don't give a shit. Who goes when and where? Whatever spot you guys don't want, give it to me.
It's sort of wild to hear how it was still like so crazy because it starts out with like 40 comics, right?
Yeah.
It goes on for like a month and people start to lose their minds.
It got really crazy.
You never lived up there?
No.
You just worked up in San Francisco a lot?
I managed to score a car.
Yeah.
And so once I got my car, I drove all over California just for the heck of it. I never drove in Chicago. I didn't know how to drive when I bought a car.
Yeah.
I didn't have any credit. I didn't have any driver's license. I had no business buying a car.
Right.
But I saw an ad that said they were for sale and problems. So
yeah.
1979 Chevy Nova.
Yeah. And,
drove it all over California.
Did you go back to Chicago to work over the time that you were in L.A.?
Yes, I did. In fact, I just, that trophy over there is from the 40th anniversary of Zanies.
Zanies.
I started there when they first opened up and would work there regularly for years and years.
So you were really there at the beginning of that comedy club boom thing. So when they started building those places, were you like on the road constantly headlining? Because I remember seeing your picture everywhere. It must have mean you must have spent a lot of time out there at those clubs when they first started opening.
Yeah, I got to. Fortunately, I got to work a lot of the franchise clubs.
Yeah,
I started, like I said, at the Laugh Stop. And the improv, then all of the other giggles, tee hee, yuck yuck, ha ha.
But you could work every week, right? For probably pretty good living.
Well, I worked, you know, if I could work a couple of times a month or
Yeah.
once a month, as long as I could make rent, I was good, you know.
Sure.
I was fine. And then spending the rest of the time in LA, trying to get other gigs,
Get on
you know.
TV.
Yeah.
So how did that happen for you? How did the 'cause like Night Court was a big deal, man.
Well, before Night Court, I was doing, like I said, I wasn't really pursuing acting.
Yeah.
My agent decided, who the agent I got after the comedy competition in San Francisco, named Fred Amzell. He was always sending me out on roles, and I'm like, I'm a stand-up. He's like, yeah, go do the thing, see what happens, what
Yeah.
the hell. And so I was, after the prior show, I got a show called That Thing on ABC. And that's how I got my first agent at ICM. I had the gig, you know, they offered me the gig, and I didn't have an agent. So I called ICM and said, I got a gig, I need an agent. They said, you have a job? I said, yes, I have a job on TV. They said,
Yeah.
you have a job on TV and you don't have an agent. I said, yes. They said, hang on. And they gave me an agent. And that was how I got an agent.
Did you
And so
stay with that person?
he passed away, one of the first AIDS victims.
Uh-huh.
And so I was there until then. And then we started doing stand-up. I did shows like the Pat Sajak show. I
Right.
did Gordon Elliott show.
Huh. I
I
don't even know
did.
what that is. Yeah.
They were a lot. Talk shows were popular at that time.
Oh, Pat
I did
Sajak,
a
right
lot.
there. Yeah, they tried to get him to be like a Carson almost.
Yeah, I did those, and I started doing game shows. I love game shows. I wanted to be the next Betty White,
Yeah.
and so I started doing those kinds of things and doing stand-up. And then Night Court, Brandon Tartikoff was from Chicago, and he was the head of president of NBC at the time. And so Reiny, who was a producer on Night Court, was also from Chicago. I had no idea either of them knew who I was.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
after Flo Hallett passed away, I had done a pilot with Flo. She had told me all these wonderful stories about her and her brother starting in show business in the 30s and 40s, and he was one of the dead end kids, Billy Hallep, and then and she was working, and I just loved talking to her.
Yeah.
So she was on Night Court, and I'm doing stand up.
Yeah.
She passed away 3 weeks before they were supposed to go back from hiatus.
Oh my
And
God.
she was the second bailiff to have died over the hiatus. Selma Diamond had passed away the year before. So they were in a tizzy. What do we do with the female bailiff part? Do we want to do it? Do we want to can it? Do we just stick with Bull? Do we have revolving bailiffs? You
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
they didn't have any idea. So Fred, my agent, sent me over there and said, just meet with them, see what happens.
Yeah.
I go in, I'm dressed pretty much like I do now. I got on sweats. I got a pack of cigarettes at the time. I smoked a pack of cigarettes in my hand. I went in, and Reiny's there. And Night Court, you have to understand, was a really big hit at this time.
So it already been on 2 seasons.
It had been on 3 seasons. I started the fourth season. So I go in, and Reiny's, how you doing? I said, how you from Chicago? Yeah, I'm from Chicago. He said, give me one of those cigarettes. I said, okay, sure. I gave him a cigarette. And we sat and smoked and just talked.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, well, we'll let you know what we're going to do. You know, it's good meeting you. And I said, thanks, good meeting you. And I left. That was, you know, because
Yeah.
I'm a stand-up.
Yeah.
So, and I was going to Seattle. So I left, went to Seattle.
To the underground.
Got off the plane. Yeah, got off the plane. They met me at the airport and said, call your agent. I said, what happened? They said, call your agent. I called my agent. He said, you got it. I said, I got what? Again, Night Court. That was that.
That's a big life change, though, right?
I had no clue what it was going to mean. One gig changes everything.
And you were in Seattle. Were you about to do the underground for Fox or
I
for?
believe so, yeah.
That's so funny, man. Just because I can picture that. You're like, I'm gonna go work the weekend in Seattle, and then you get that job, and the whole life changes.
There you go. I think I did the weekend and showed up the, you know, Monday morning.
Sure. You went ahead and did the weekend. Of course. How, that's what you do. But like when you get back, so you'd only done stand up on television, really. Oh, and the Richard Pryor thing. But I mean, I can't, but right. now you're
that thing on ABC, but I had never done ensemble work. So, and I never, you know, done anything like that. So I am petrified and I'm nervous as all get out.
Yeah.
Almost as nervous as when I did that sketch with Richard Pryor where we're sitting around eating. I didn't know what to do. There was no script to do that scene. There was no.
Which scene was that?
Richard and I eating, seducing each other across a restaurant.
Oh, okay.
And I had no dialogue, no nothing. All it said was Richard comes in, sees a beautiful woman, and they seduce each other with food.
Uh-huh.
It goes viral 3 times a year on
YouTube.
Classic. It's been shared so many times. I had no clue at the time how to do it. I just did it on instinct. So I go to do Night Court, and I figure I got to take acting classes. I talk to my agent. And I said, well, who do I? Do? I mean, right now. It's 2 weeks we go into that. I got to know. You go and you take this class. And I went to the class and we did one little scene. And they said, you got to buy a book. You know, part of the thing, once you buy a book, they read the book and come back next week. So I bought the book. I opened it up to page one. It said, the key to acting is to keep it simple. So I closed the book and never looked at it again. Showed up at work the next time when I went to birthday. And I told Harry, I said, I'm so nervous. I don't know what I'm doing. He said, I don't know what I'm doing either. I'm a stand-up dude. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. And that was happening.
I guess that must have been pretty exciting. I mean, in terms of, you know, I can't imagine, like I've worked with, not like that ensemble. There were so many, you know, great comedic actors on there, but just to be sort of getting in the flow of that, like seeing how everyone else is funny and then kind of feeling how you're funny among these people. It must've been exciting.
It was very exciting. It was a learning process. You know, I learned a lot.
Yeah.
And I got, you know, stretched a lot. You know, way out of my comfort zone.
Oh yeah. How so?
Because I'm a stand-up.
Yeah, I know, but as a stand-up, I you keep saying that, and I say that too, but there's so many stand-ups that end up in television one way or the other, and I guess it takes a minute for us to learn how to act. But, you know, once you get the hang of it, you got pretty comfortable, didn't you?
Well, to a degree, but I was much more excited when I got comfortable on stage doing stand-up. I think some people start in the business as stand-ups, but they're not stand-ups. They don't want to do
for
stand-up.
For sure.
They just use it as a stepping stone. I never looked at it that way.
Yeah, me neither.
I wanted to be a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
And so the acting was nice, but it was a sideline. In my mind, I was still going out on weekends and doing gigs. I would get finished, you know, with Night Court on Friday night. I'm on a plane at 6 the next morning. To be wherever, to do some weekend somewhere.
No, and yeah, I get it.
I was doing stand-up, so.
And also, it's like with the stand-up, it's our thing. You know, we have complete control. We are the only one doing it. It's what we do. It's how we share our thoughts and our heart. And, you know, and no one can fuck with it.
Well, you're the philosopher, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a necessary function, you know, those critiques of society that keep people honest, you know, bullshit callers. I call bullshit on that.
Yeah, I always thought that was a very important job.
Yeah, so that's where I wanted to be. That's what I wanted to do. And the only other woman at the time who was doing that kind of grab the mic and, you know, state your opinion.
Yeah.
Was Elaine Boozler.
Yeah, Elaine Boozler. Yeah. I keep trying to get her on the show. I think she's mad at me. I'm not sure why.
Now, well, if you got a puppy.
I know. I got to tell her I need help with my doggy. Mm-hmm. She likes the dogs. I don't know what I did to offend her, but like, were you guys close? Were you and Elaine?
We hung out, you know, we were part of the strike, mm-hmm. the commuter strike. And
so you were there for the strike. What year was that?
77, 78.
Really? That was the, oh my God. So you were there when Libitkin killed himself?
Yes. I was very much involved.
Yeah. Because I read the book and I can't like figure out, I can't quite remember. And I talked to Dreesen about it. That was pretty heavy, man. You know, because you know Dreesen never went back there. You know, after Steve committed suicide.
No, well, we had pretty hard feelings. Yeah, we're from Chicago. I'm from a union background. My mother was a union rep, president of her tri-state local. Okay, yeah. She was union. You know,
right?
Look for the union label, Being from Chicago and of union protections, I mean, I've been in a union since I was 15.
Yeah.
And it was just so unfair that comedians weren't getting paid.
Yeah.
And while at the same time, the Comedy Store franchise was exploding. She didn't own, you know, the building when we first got there. No, that was the annex was a little room they just let her have. That was, you know, and next thing you know, she owned Ciro's. Well, it wasn't Ciro's, but you know,
yeah,
that tradition, that room, that legend.
Yeah.
And La Jolla, she's got property in La Jolla. There were two condos in La Jolla. You got two condos in La Jolla. You got a ranch in the back. You got clubs and Westwood and whatnot, and nobody's getting paid.
Yeah.
That just was, I couldn't wrap my head around.
So you're dug into the organizing with Tom?
Yeah.
There must have been a very weird and crazy time to deal with the comics that crossed the line.
Yes.
And the tensions that happened there.
Those, you know, and I will not name them, but they're are still hard feelings about that. I've never forgiven them.
Really?
Never.
And ultimately, though, the strike, we did get paid, right?
Bud Friedman, right away.
Yeah.
Whatever Mitzi gives you, I'll meet. Whatever.
Yeah.
And so that's when people started going to the improv, because in the beginning you couldn't work both.
Wouldn't let you, or they both wouldn't let you.
You couldn't let, and it was a location thing.
Yeah.
For some reason, people felt like stopping off the strip was better than stop. Melrose, nothing was happening at that. The Melrose was paint stores and,
right.
You know, empty lots. There was nothing going on there. And so people would, on their way to the Valley, stopped at the Comedy Store.
Yeah.
Well, once the strike started happening, the boycott, and then everybody's, and Bud said, I'll pay you. Everybody moved to the improv.
Wow. So that's what.
I ended up being managed by Bud.
You did?
Yeah.
How long were you managed by Bud?
Oh, until right before I got Night Court.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Did you get along with him all right?
Sure, him and his family, I would say, you know, I just hung out at the improv. They would have dance nights and stuff. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I did all that.
So were you then, like, were you on Mitzi's bad side after that?
I never went back to the Comedy Store. Well, I did go back. And then one night she bumped me for Glenn Super.
Glenn Super?
Yeah.
The guy with the megaphone?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So that was the end of that.
That was that. That was it for me. I was done. And so, you'll go on after. Yeah. No, I won't.
Were there several comics that didn't go back after the strike?
Well, some of us went back for a minute and whatever, but it just wasn't, it was no longer a good fit, and it was no longer the only game in town.
Yeah.
Jamie Masada, who at that time was hanging out at the Comedy Store, and during the strike, Jamie was about 15, 16.
Really?
I'll open a club. I'm going to open a club. I'm going to give you guys. I'll pay you guys. I swear. I'm going to open a club and I'm going to pay you guys. I don't care because this is not fair. This is not right. And he was always around the strike. He was always around.
Yeah.
And so everybody was like, yeah, you're going to open a club.
Yeah.
And sure enough, he opened a club.
I remember that place back then. Yeah. Well, the original place, it was like almost like a hallway. It was like next to that Chinese restaurant. But it was that, remember, you walk in and you're in the room. And you had to walk all the way down to go to the bathroom, which was like, you know, right next to the stage. Right?
I vaguely remember that place. Now that you mention it, I know it was over there. Wasn't it over there by Greenblatt's?
Yeah, it was next to the old Formosa before they closed it down.
Oh, on Melrose?
No, not Formosa. No, the Chinese restaurant, that Greenblatt's. Like, remember there was a Chinese restaurant next to the original Laugh Factory that I think became Greenblatt? I don't remember, but
Greenblatt's had been there, but I remember, you know, it's all a jumble now.
Right there. Yeah.
It's 100 years ago, man.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah,
and he opened it. He did it. He opened the club.
He did it, and it's a Hollywood institution now.
Now it is, yeah.
And I remember him as a kid.
So once you start doing the night court, did that get your ticket sales up, and did everything change in that way?
Oh, that it was amazing. The night the day after it aired, my stock went up with the community and the comedians right away.
Yeah, right.
But once the night after the first show aired, I had no idea what celebrity was. You know, even though I was headlining clubs, working around and doing fine, I was happy. Just the night court. I was not prepared for it. And the thing that really shook me most was I had lost my observer status.
Ah.
As a comedian, you know. We're the observers.
Yeah.
And I had no point, no place to observe. Everywhere I went, I was being observed. And so
it was a
very strange thing for me to get used to. I don't know that I ever did.
Well, that's interesting because even when I started doing this show, you know, like I've been doing comedy all my life. You know, and then once this got popular, people go, I really like the podcast. And I think like, well, what about the stand-up? I've been doing stand-up my whole life.
Yeah,
and a lot of people don't know about it. But like when you're a comic in your heart, that's the priority. And it becomes this weird world you live in where you want to make sure at least know that people are appreciating you for what you love to do. Right?
Right. Yeah. But, you know, it's part of the game and part of the thing, you know.
But you were selling tickets at least, and you know, I imagine you were writing new material either way, right?
Oh, what I had gotten to the point before I retired for quite a few years, I had gotten to the point where stand up was easy.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's a good thing.
Why? Because everyone, because you were popular?
No, because I was so comfortable in what I was doing. I knew that if I wrote a joke, I could do it that night and it was going to hit. I knew how to do stand-up.
Right.
It took a while. I knew how to do stand-up. And it kind of lost the challenge for a minute.
Interesting.
And then when I started back again a few years ago, all that was gone. I was a rookie. I had to start from scratch. And so I started in going back to bars, going back to, you know, the bare minimum, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And started from the ground up.
How long were you out for?
Almost 20 years.
And you moved to Vegas. Now, when you moved to Vegas, did you have a residency there or something?
No, I did not work after the... After 2001, I did not work until about 2016.
And why? Did you get like depressed or something, or are you just done?
Oh, it was a combination of a lot of things. but it was a more family oriented than anything else.
Oh yeah.
And I needed to be here with family. And until I could, that I wasn't as needed.
Right.
And start back again.
Huh. And how are you finding it?
It's very interesting. As a, you know, I started as a 60-year-old rookie.
Yeah.
And it's humbling in one way, but in another way, it's so exhilarating. It's like to be at this age and still have things to look forward to, still have goals to meet and you know, along the way, steps to take is a blessing. I see a lot of people my age who don't. They've crossed everything off.
Right.
And now, know, on their bucket list are things that just fun stuff, you know, and just, you know, I want to go to Hawaii.
Yeah.
Well, on my bucket list is I want to work here. I want to go there. I want to do this. I want to get my own show. I want to do this. I want to do a one woman show. I can have things. It gives me things to look forward to, which is, like I said, a blessing at my age.
Well, I mean, also you've got your observer status back. And
well, that's a good thing. It's a double-edged sword. Nobody cares if you watch.
Yeah, and it seems like there that you've had a life and a lot of changes in your life that you could address probably in a way that you couldn't address back when you were doing stand-up before.
Yeah, well, that comes with living, you know.
Yeah.
I think all of us, it's a different stand-up at this age than it was at 22.
What do you talk about? Because I know that you went through stuff with your family, and I did some reading, and I know that you came out recently. Now, do you talk about that stuff?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Do you find that there's a new audience for it?
For me, every audience is new.
Right.
But I've always wanted to do stand up for a cross section of. I never wanted to do so much all women, all gays, all blacks, all this.
Yeah,
all
sure, this. Sure.
I wanted young people, old people, and I'm finding that I'm getting that if the audiences are diverse and, you know, some not receptive because I don't shy away from the topics that are really moving the country right now, the racism, the sexism, the, you know, ageism,
yeah.
All of that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard for people to take.
Yeah.
But I say you can't fix what you won't face. And so let's put it on the table and let's talk about it. I'm going to come from a point of view you might not have heard.
But like for you in terms of facing stuff, I mean, it seems like it did take you a long time to at least publicly deal with being open about your sexuality. But
yes.
But that wasn't because you were hiding it. It was just because.
Well, so much has happened, you know, and the benefit for me, I look back, my act is pretty much a retrospective.
Yeah.
That brings us to today.
Yeah.
You know, I talk about how I was born the same year, Oprah Winfrey, a couple of months apart.
Yeah.
In the year of Brown versus the Board of Education. So we grew up with the civil rights movement. And I take it from there, you know. And that is a perspective that I don't know that you always get, you know, that how we got here, what it was like to be gay in the 50s and 60s and not have any concept of homosexuality whatsoever. None. It was not talked about. It was not, there were no, it was just not spoken of.
Right.
And so to not be able to find what makes you different.
Mm.
Everybody will tell you you're different.
Mm.
Nobody says how. And so you just know that nothing makes sense.
Mm.
And
there was no community.
If it was, it wasn't. I wasn't allowed to know it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was like not, it just was not on the radar. People did active things to keep you from that.
Sure.
See, they saw what they saw, and they tried to stop you. Like, it's like when kids would be left-handed.
Yeah.
You saw your baby going for their left hand, then you smack their hand, and you. Some people went so far as to tie them right behind their back so they would have to favor their
right. Right.
And they did the same thing with children they thought were gay. It's like, oh, he wants to play with that doll. No, you can't play with that doll. You have to play with this G.I. Joe and go kill something. You're a boy.
Right.
To have those kinds of negative reinforcements, but not have any idea what you're being protected from.
Right.
Was a different thing that I don't know kids have to face now. At least they know why people hate them, but at least they know why they don't fit in.
Right. Right. Yeah, there's at least, now there's definitely a strong community that they can, they know what their feelings are, and they know that they're okay, at least to some people.
Right.
Right?
They at least know they exist.
That's and right. And you got, was there like a lot of family pressure, like to not, be...
It's hard to put into so people understand. It was, don't you want to look nice? Don't you want to look pretty? Why do you want to wear jeans? Why do you want to do this? Why don't you want to get your hair done? Why don't you be a lady?
Yeah.
And all of those things.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do that. I want to, why do I have to, what is boy stuff and girl stuff? Why is it boy, girl? Why can't I, you know?
Just do what I want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so... it wasn't so much, you know, you can't be blah, 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 blah. You know, it
sure.
was more like, this is what you're supposed to be. And I don't feel that.
And most of it, I think, you know, the more benign, it seems like a lot of times it's out of concern that,
sure.
that parents do that. It's not good, but they think your life is going to be more difficult.
And trying to protect you, but we know more now.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, I don't feel resentful. I feel, like they did the best they could. They were wrong.
Yeah. Why did it take you so long, do you think, to be public about it?
Well, you have to remember, nobody was public about it until Ellen.
Right.
And she paid a price for that.
I guess that's true.
There were a lot of people
right.
who I have found out myself
right.
Who were gay.
Yeah.
I had no idea. And I knew them.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
We didn't talk about it. It wasn't something that was spoken of.
That's sad, it seems. But now, now everything's on the table. You feel better?
Fine, I just don't want, my whole thing is I don't want any more kids growing up that way.
Yeah, afraid to be who they are.
Right.
Well, that's good. I think that's good.
I don't want any more celebrities to die with that secret.
Right.
Had to live their whole lives as sex symbols, some of them.
Right.
As objects of other people's desire, but they couldn't express who they were. I don't want that to happen again. If I have any little bit of influence, any tiny little bit of influence, that's what I want to use it for.
Do you have, I know we're all kind of stuck in this horrendous virus situation and now a very sort of active and explosive protest situation. Do you have hope in general?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
I've always been a bit of a realist.
Uh-huh.
There are things that won't be addressed because people don't want to face them.
Right.
We don't want to face the horrors that we have committed.
Right.
As a nation, as people, as we have been horrible to each other. And as some people have gotten much more of the brunt of the negative than others.
Mm.
And as a nation, as people, we don't want to face that. And until we do, we'll keep having these spot fires, instead of just addressing the whole thing before the whole thing burns up.
Right.
And so I have hope that, you know, these little spot fires are going to be put out, but I don't know that I have as much hope that they're going to prevent the forest fire.
You
got to realize that it could all go up. And until we face that, we're going to keep, it's been going on periodically. You go back in history, I mean, these things happen pretty regularly.
The oppression and the sort of creating the systemic racist state has been going on since the beginning of the country.
Right. And then there's somebody says, hey, stop that.
There's
war. And there's this and there's Reconstruction. And then the people say, fuck that.
Yeah.
We want our slaves back. And they come back and they're the lost cause and start building the hero statues and say they've been gone with the wind and just rewriting history.
Yep.
And then it comes like you have a Harlem Renaissance and a people migration and their thing and a boom. And then you got the, you know, Tulsa race riots, this, that, and other. And there's a Jim Crow and the civil rights movement. And we finally overcame. And then, no, we didn't. There's the Southern thing in the bombing. And now here we are.
Yeah.
And we refuse to understand that it's going to keep happening until you
fix it.
Realize that it's, you know, it's not black, white, male, female. As a quadruple minority.
Yeah.
You know, you get to see everybody's nuttiness, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so.
Well, I hope we can at least acknowledge it before the big fire.
I do too. I hope we can fix it. I hope we, you know, you and I can do our part.
Yeah. Well, I think we just did a little bit.
And help people understand this. It'll be okay.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. It was great talking to you, Marcia.
Thank you. It's great talking to you, too.
Mike Binder says hi, by the way, and I'll tell him we had a nice talk.
I'll tell him I said hello. Okay. I remember him. He was a tiny kid. He was brand new.
I know, he was. Like a teenager, right?
Yeah, he and Dave Chappelle and Eddie Griffin.
Oh, the guys who started when they were young?
They called me an old lady back then.
Yeah, I remember Chappelle when he was like 16, 17, coming up to New York.
But he was a great student. And he wanted to know everything. He wanted to know everything. He and Chris Rock. And, you know, these were teenagers when I met him. They wanted to know and they wanted to hang out. They wanted to learn. They did.
They sure did.
And now they're teaching everybody.
That's for sure. All right. You take care of yourself.
You too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was great talking to Marcia Warfield, still out there working when she can, when we all can. A legend. All right, now I will play some guitar. rumor lives.